The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 201.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone to the Rebel Capitalist Show, a good buddy of Doug Casey that I've really been looking forward to speaking with. And I've got a backstory on Nick, and I don't even think he knows about it. But Nick Giambruno, welcome to the Rebel Capitalist Show, my friend.
Hey, great to be with you, George.
First of all, for my viewers who don't know your backstory, can you get us up to speed there?
Well, sure. I've worked closely with legendary speculator, crisis investor, contrarian, anarcho-capitalist Doug Casey for many years now. I originally met Doug in Beirut, Lebanon. I used to live and work in Lebanon, in Beirut, which is a financial center of sorts. It used to be. I worked for an investment bank based out of Dubai, but had a satellite office in Beirut. And I had been reading Doug's material for many years, was a huge fan of his. He put it out in his newsletter because he goes around to these weird places. He goes to random shitholes and likes to see new places. And I happen to be in, Beirut's, it's got a rough reputation, but it's actually a very beautiful city in regards, we can get into that later. But anyways, I was there working. Doug put it out in one of his dispatches that he was coming to Beirut, and if he had any readers who wanted to get a cup of coffee, to reply to his email. So I replied. I didn't expect he would say, sure, let's get together and meet, but he did. And that was the start of a business relationship, and he's been a mentor to me ever since.
Wow, that is super cool. And so when did you start doing actual writing with Doug and going to these locations with him and looking at the crisis investing opportunities? And how would you define crisis investing?
Sure. Well, I met Doug, it must have been 2010. And I started, we kept in touch, and I really started working with him at the end of 2011 or in sometime in 2012. And we started going around to crisis markets looking for extreme value. So, I mean, that's where you really, the reason you go to crisis markets is because that's where you get the most extreme valuations on being cheap. I mean, people aren't accustomed to seeing this. We've lived in such a warped market and warped, people forget how cheap things can get. I mean, we live in this crazy world of insane valuations. But when you go to a crisis market, the pendulum swings the other way. And I don't think many people remember what that's like. So one of the first places we went to, this was in 2013, right after the banking system exploded in Cyprus. And it was radioactive. Nobody wanted to touch it. So we went to Cyprus to look for some bargains, because this is something Doug has gone to crisis markets. He's fundamentally a value investor, too. So where do you get the most extreme value is in these crisis markets. And that one happened to be a ripe opportunity at that time. So we got on a plane a few weeks after they had their banking collapse to see what was going on there, because you have to have boots on the ground. You have to have firsthand insight. You can't just depend on what they're saying in The Economist or Wall Street Journal. You got to see for yourself. Exactly. So we went, and we found that there were actually some very interesting opportunities. The stock market, since its peak in 2007, and then after this crisis in 2013, was down like 90-something percent from its peak. So there was a stock market, there's a stock exchange in Cyprus, and literally half of the issues that were inactive. There were no buyers showing up to even offer a bid. So this was the perfect kind of a situation. So that was a starting point. And we looked for companies that might have good value. And we found some that were trading at some point, at some were trading less than 25% of book value, had cash, paying dividends, the debt burden wasn't high, and they had sound businesses. But it was just toxic because of this overarching broad macro crisis that nobody wanted to touch Cyprus. And in that environment, we found some very good stocks. And so that was the first one that we did. Definitely not the last.
Okay, so let me tell you my story. I don't know if you know this, but I retired in 2012. Mm-hmm. And when I retired, I didn't know anything about investing, but I really started to study first Milton Friedman and Thomas Sowell, economists like that. But then I really started to get into the background of guys like Jim Rogers and this type of crisis value investing. And then I started reading your work with Doug. And I don't know if you guys remember, but you wrote a report on Cyprus back in 2013 or so. And I actually bought that report and yeah. I read it and I'm like, you know what? This makes a lot of sense. And mm-hmm. I said it and I took the advice that you guys gave at the back of your report. I called the broker you guys suggested. I set up an account with that broker and I didn't know, back then the only thing I knew about as far as investing was real estate. Because I started investing in real estate in 2012 when I retired. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, well, the only thing I even remotely understand out of all these stocks is the hotel chain.
Yes.
Lourdes Hotels. You remember
that's
that?
Right. Wow.
So I sent my money over there to the broker and it was actually pretty smooth. And I mm-hmm. bought that stock but I didn't buy enough of it to where I'm, checking the ticker every single day because I'm trying to follow that that strategy that Jim Rogers, you just kind of wait for a big pile of money to show up in the corner, you go pick it up, but then you kind of set it and forget it. And if you're buying cheap, it should work out if you do that throughout your entire portfolio. And so I think I checked it maybe 6 months later or something like that. I don't even remember really where it was. But what's interesting is I never sold. I just kept it, why not? And about a year ago, I think I was doing a video where I thought, this is a good example, maybe this crisis investing. So let me go email my broker and try to, because I didn't know my password or anything like that, because I hadn't checked the account in years.
Wow.
And so he emailed, I don't know if it's the same guy, but they emailed me my password. I looked at my account and sure enough, I bought that stock at 10 or 12 cents a share. And at the time, I was paying like a 10% dividend, like a one penny dividend or something. And then I checked it, a year or two ago, whatever it was, and it was like 88 or 90 cents.
Yeah.
It had gone up like 8 times. And then what was incredible is the dividend that I had been earning went from 10% up to, on my cost basis, up like 30 or 40%. They were paying like a nickel dividend. And I'm like, wow, this is fantastic, but just a great example of yes. buying when there's blood in the streets. And one thing I'll end with, and I'd love to get your thought on this, is I don't think most people realize that you make a lot more money when a situation goes from horrible to bad than you do buying when a situation goes from good to great.
Oh, absolutely. I completely agree. But first, let me congratulate you. That was not an easy trade to make for anybody. So congratulations. You deserve every basis point on that profit. That's amazing. I'm sure you actually made more than your initial capital back just in dividends alone over that period. But that's phenomenal. So great job. And it wasn't necessarily an easy trade to make. When you look at these extreme situations, oftentimes you have to open a brokerage account in Cyprus. How many Fidelities or even Interactive Brokers, they're not going to give you access to the Cyprus Stock Exchange. To find an opportunity like the Lourdes Hotel has to justify the extra hoops you have to jump through to make that trade. So you did a fantastic job with that. That I'm very happy to hear that. Very happy to hear.
Well, thank you for the report and thanks for doing the research. I thank Doug as well, by the way.
Yes.
So on that, what do you see nowadays as far as crisis investing opportunities? And I think in the future, we're going to see a lot more of them because what the central banks are doing around the world, I'd love to get your take on that. But what are you looking at as far as that type of investment in the world today right now?
Yes, it's much, much trickier due to all of the money printing that's gone on. That's totally warped valuations beyond any sane levels pretty much anywhere in the world. And things like Cyprus, they don't happen every day, but they're not completely infrequent either. So it's good to kind of keep an eye out for them when they do occur. honestly, there's not a Cyprus type situation going on at the moment right now. I'm in Argentina though at the moment, and Argentina is extremely cheap, but I suspect it's going to get even cheaper because they're on the cusp of a perennial hyperinflation, which happens like clockwork here. So I suspect that will happen in the next year, 18 months. And when that happens, you can look for bargains in Argentina. I think that could be a place you could look because I think they are genuinely headed to one of these crises. Not yet, but soon. So where do you find value?
What do you think about Venezuela on that note?
Yeah, that is also tricky too. That you could find value in Venezuela. That is even more challenging because of sanctions and financial restrictions, and the fact that you would have to. I've looked into Venezuela. There's no Venezuelan stocks that trade in the U.S. There's no Venezuelan stocks that trade in any accessible international market. What that means is you got to go to Caracas and open a brokerage account, much like you did in Cyprus. However, it's going to be much harder to do than it was in Cyprus because of sanctions. Venezuela's on very hard, tough sanctions, getting money in, getting money out. Right. I concluded it's really not worth it because the only way to get money in legally, Venezuela has a bunch of different exchange rates. You're going to get raped on the exchange rate. They're going to take. It's not like you're going to get an honest exchange rate if you wire money. If you can somehow get past the sanctions to wire money to Venezuela, they're going to confiscate it with a bad exchange rate, which is not the market exchange rate. So the only way to do that is to bring physical money there or find a way to get money in. And it's just been tricky. Real estate is also an interesting opportunity in Venezuela, too. If there is, I think, a place called Isla Margarita, which is an and off of Venezuela, that is an interesting, potentially interesting area. But, you know, there's lots of problems with that. So it hasn't worked out as a practical manner, but it's on my radar.
Yeah, the logistics with Cyprus were very easy.
Yes.
And I think that's probably the main, and then that it was on the euro.
Yes.
So you didn't have a lot of that currency fluctuation and all that craziness. So when you look at these crisis markets and you're kind of doing this research with Doug, what do you look for as far as a catalyst? Because you said with Argentina that it's probably going to get worse. And I know studying Jim Rogers for all these years, it's not just going in and buying something when it's dirt cheap. You've got to see some sort of catalyst that would most likely trigger a move, or that macro event has got to be temporary, which I would argue would fall into what Cyprus was all about. Yes. So how do you guys determine a catalyst, and what do you generally look for?
Yeah, that is hugely important because things can stay cheap for many years.
And that's
what you want to look for. What is helpful is finding places. You know, you look at what the media is telling you is a disaster, because that they typically overblow these things. When you look back at Cyprus, they overblew Cyprus. They totally overblew it. So what you want to look for is a disconnect between the media, how the media portrays it, and what's really going on. And that also is another reason why I found Colombia. Colombia is attractive, too. I mean, they've had a chronic it's basically over. Maybe it's on again, off again. But, you know, they had the longest running war in the Americas, 50-year war. And it's basically over. Colombia's turned a new leaf. So I look for a perception gap. And when you can find that perception gap, usually a lot of that negativity is because of what the media is pumping. And when the situation goes from horrible to bad, as you were talking, that's when the situation goes from horrible to bad, when the media finds the next shiny object. Okay, it's gone from horrible to bad, not horrible to good, but that's one of the things. And it's a case-by-case basis. Cyprus had, for the example of Cyprus, they had different catalysts. They were exploiting gas reserves offshore. That was going to be a boom to their economy. They were going to go through certain metrics, such as removing capital controls, which would more money would come in. So it's really a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, good point. So when did you start looking at Colombia? I don't know if you know this, but I started investing there in real estate in 2015, and I've been doing so heavily, and I've got a team there of 20, 30 people, when you include the subs and everything, that we go and we buy and renovate those apartments down in the Provenza area around Parque Arias and the Golden Mile and that whole area, I'm sure that you know well. But I started doing that in 2015 because of a macro situation where the price of oil got down below $30 a barrel. And I knew nothing about oil, but I knew a lot about real estate. So I said, well, okay, the Colombian peso is kind of tied to oil. So if I buy an asset denominated in pesos, it's kind of like doing the same, going long oil. So I'll just buy Colombian real estate. So that's how I started. But then once I spent time in Medellin, I'm like, wow, this is fantastic. If you look at the price per square meter relative to the rest of South America, it's super cheap. And then what I discovered is the market is so wildly inefficient that if you're a local expert, you can really exploit that. Or if you're just a gringo coming down trying to buy something on a website, you're most likely going to be the person being exploited. But anyway, can you go into a deep dive on your analysis with Colombia?
Well, you know, you described exactly how I came to Colombia. I also came to Colombia in 2015. I came initially at the invitation of an emerging cannabis company. And while there, I was investigating real estate too. And you're right. At that time, I had the exact same kind of investment thesis in Medellin because of what was going on with the oil price. And that made Medellin and Colombia assets in general extremely cheap for people holding dollars, because actually oil is one of the largest exports of Colombia. Right. And when oil price goes down, that hurts the local currency. But what's unique to Colombia is that real estate trades in the local currency. It trades in pesos. Most real estate in Latin America trades in US dollars. So it doesn't really matter if there's much fluctuation with the exchange rate. Colombia is different. So when the peso depreciates by 30%, well, real estate just got 30% cheaper for US dollar holders, which was terrific. So I actually had the exact same investment thesis, looked over there and found it to be extremely attractive. Rental yields were very compelling. Cost per square meter was extremely compelling. And it also had the added ingredient of being kind of a contrarian play. You just ask the average person what they think of Medellin. They think it's a war zone and Pablo Escobar and all that crap you see on Netflix. So, yeah, that was part of its history, but it's its history. This is not how it is today at all. Anybody who's been there would tell you the same. So that's kind of what played into it. It was a value play. It was, I still call it somewhat of a crisis investing play. The crisis is just a chronic 50-year crisis. I mean, back in 2015, it was. People still, there was no peace deal. There was none of that yet. So it was still considered a war zone, Colombia, involved in an act of war. So it was, it checked all the boxes, and it's a pleasant place to be. You know, it's the city of eternal springtime year round. It's a beautiful place. So I'm still bullish on Colombia, Medellin. I like it and would consider, looking at other investments there.
What do you think about Turkey right now?
Yeah, I don't think Turkey's hit rock bottom. I think we really need to see. I think it's cheap. No question, it's cheap. But I think we really need to see kind of a currency collapse. It's been the lira, the Turkish lira has lost a lot of its value. But it's not one of those crises that are plastered across global headlines where it's Turkey's become toxic. I think that could happen, though. I think Turkey is definitely a candidate for a kind of Cyprus-type situation to unfold in the near future. So I'd keep a close watch on it.
Okay. How do you find these crisis markets? Like, are you just reading headlines on the Wall Street Journal? Or, one thing I did is I tried to go online, this was several years ago, and look at, from the U.S. standpoint, like find websites that listed the most dangerous places in the world for Americans or something like that. And those were like my top picks. I put them on like a watch list of places where I might want to buy.
Yes.
Like, do you do something like that?
Well, it's more of an art than a science finding these crisis markets, because you're gauging and measuring psychology, and that's a tricky thing to do. So it's looking where people don't want to go, that something that becomes completely toxic, completely radioactive, right. And then taking a look and saying, wait a minute, mate, is there anything of value there? Doesn't happen every day, doesn't happen often, but when it does, it's worth looking at for sure.
Okay, let's talk about cannabis.
Yes.
And just FYI, last time I spoke with Jim Rogers, when we got done with the interview, or actually maybe we were still recording, I don't recall, but you know, we were talking about Medellin. We were talking about real estate, and you know, he was asking me a bunch of questions. So he asked me if I had looked into buying a cannabis farm up in the hills there, and it just kind of out of blue, or out of the blue. And I'm like, no, I haven't thought about that. But kind of what that told me is that Jim was maybe thinking about making that type of investment. So have you looked into that in Colombia specifically, or maybe just cannabis plays in the United States, Canada, any places where it's becoming more acceptable?
Yes, I've had some very big wins with cannabis companies. I just closed out a 10-bagger in December of a cannabis REIT, a real estate investment trust. But first, let me state, most cannabis stocks are absolute garbage. They're right. Crap. They're total crap. So this is you're walking in a minefield here. So what you got to do is and you know, there's a lot of excitement in this space, and now too. I mean, federal legalization appears to be happening somewhat soon. So there's a lot of excitement in this space. But what you want to do is you want to focus on companies that have competitive advantages. I mean, just throwing some seeds in the ground and growing this stuff, that's not a competitive advantage. Anybody can do that. You want to find somebody, some company that has something that other people can't copy. And there aren't many cannabis companies like that. There's a few that I like that have partnerships with large alcohol companies, large tobacco companies that give them access to supply chains and different ways to distribute their products. And they have a big source of capital. Some have intellectual property where they've got patents on certain drugs. Others are investigating what I have been focusing on in my cannabis research are companies that are focusing on, because everybody knows about THC and CBD, but those are just two of 113 or so cannabinoids. These are the compounds, the chemical compounds found in the cannabis plant that actually interact with a system that every mammal has, every human, not just every human, every mammal has an endocannabinoid system, basically receptors all over your body where the chemical compounds in cannabis interact with to produce a different effect. Literally, it's mind-blowing when you can consider, we only know just a little bit about THC. We only know just a little bit about CBD. And, you know, CBD is now well known to treat seizures. It helps treat people who have seizures. But the fact is that people knew about this. There's a researcher in Israel who studied CBD in the 80s. They've known that CBD can treat seizures since the 1980s. But it's just been restricted in because of this hysteria with the war on some drugs. So there is a lot more medicinal potential in this plant. And I think we're going to find more of it as it's legalized, as it's studied. You're going to find more uses for CBD and THC itself. But then there's 111 other compounds like THC and like CBD. They just exist in trace amounts, very, very small amounts that make it impractical to study without a legal framework to do so. And I think once that legal framework is there, you're going to find a lot of interesting things coming out of this plant. So I focus on those companies that are at the cutting edge of this space and researching these 111 other cannabinoids.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Do you think there's an arbitrage play there, like a geo-arbitrage? And kind of what I'm getting at is I spoke with Simon Black the other day, and he looks at blueberries, I think, the same way. He's got some crops in Chile. And he'll say, listen, you know, you get the same price for blueberries, whether they were grown in Chile or grown in California. So why wouldn't you go where the land is extremely cheap, where you've got cheap labor, and your input cost a lot lower, but you're selling for the same price and you're pocketing the spread. Is there an opportunity like that, maybe with cannabis, when you're comparing the United States to something like Colombia?
Certainly. Colombia is probably one of the best, if not the best place to grow cannabis in the world. And that's no surprise. Colombia has long been involved. Well, not just that, not because of that, but they've been involved in the flower industry, the non-cannabis flower industry. And one of their other largest exports are flowers. So what is cannabis? It's just a flower of the cannabis plant. So their gear and their geography makes it such. They can grow year round. They have a perfect climate. They have an educated workforce that is familiar with greenhouses, with horticulture, and this kind of stuff. I think it's probably
where most people's minds are going right now, Nick. Yeah. They've got a population that's very familiar with growing things.
They do. Well, that's in there too. So I don't know. I can't. And it's a very low cost structure. I mean, if you want to grow cannabis in Canada in the wintertime indoors, yeah, your cost structure is going to be much, much higher than it is in Colombia. That's true. I think there is an arbitrage opportunity. Frankly, I'm not as interested in it because that kind of, you know, you're looking at that point, cannabis has become more of a, you know, a commodity. You're arbitraging a commodity, which is fine. That's fine. You can make money doing that. But I think the real big money in cannabis is at the cutting edge research into the 111 other cannabinoids and other kinds of and other companies that have intellectual property with potential blockbuster drugs. I think that's where the real big gains are in cannabis personally.
Okay, got it. So let's talk about having a plan B.
Yes.
And I always mention this on my YouTube channel and on my live streams and on Twitter, that there's just really no downside. And a lot of pushback I get from Americans is to say, listen, I just can't pack up and go to Puerto Rico for Act 2022 or Act 60, I think they call it now. I can't just renounce my citizenship and go to St. Bart's with Hugh Hendry. It's not realistic for me. So I try to outline a plan B for those people who might not have the flexibility with their family situation, their schedule, or might not have the financial resources. And then I also, or maybe then I try to outline a plan B for people who do have those resources. But then I also try to figure out, okay, if I'm the typical American working 9 to 5, I can't leave my job. I've got a family. I live in an urban area. You know, what can I do to maybe protect myself from an overreaching government or maybe the future of social unrest or civil unrest becoming more extreme in the United States? So how do you usually answer those questions?
Sure. I think it's helpful to take a step back and look at what we're trying to do with a plan B. What is the idea here? The idea here is to make yourself not susceptible, not at risk. It's about diversifying political risk, much like how you would diversify investment risk by holding different asset classes within a portfolio. You have to take that same concept and apply it to political risk, because the biggest threat to your personal well-being, your financial well-being, is our politicians. It's the government. It's clearly. Yep. So how you can't just ignore this threat. It's the biggest threat everybody faces. So how do you do that? You got to put your life into different buckets, different categories, and try to diversify within that. Your finances, your money, yourself, your citizenship. where you have a legal right to be, your business, your income. Look at all of your digital presence. Digital presence is a big thing. So look at, you want to look at broadly the different categories of your life and do as much as you can to make it so that you are not at the whim of any group of bureaucrats within that category. And when you can do that, that's what a real Plan B is. And it's very liberating. It's really the only way you can live that's as a free sovereign individual in this in these crazy times. It's the best thing you can do. I don't know anything better you can do. I live it. I know a lot of people who live it. Doug Casey lives it. So what can the average person do? There's a lot that the average person can do. First, you can look at your money. Look at what you're saving in. You can take a little bit of your savings and sweep that into a form of money that isn't controlled by a state. You can sweep it into gold. You can sweep it. You buy a silver coin. Buy Bitcoin. Bitcoin is a wonderful way for the average person to escape to reduce the risk to their savings that from politicians, whether it's confiscation, inflation, capital controls, freezing people's accounts. So you're looking at making yourself self-sovereign in these other categories. So anybody can do that. Anybody can buy a $20, $30 silver coin. Anybody can put $50 into Bitcoin and let that build up. And what you're doing is you're diversifying that part of your savings out of any politician's purview. And you want to do that with every aspect of your life, not just your savings, your business, your income, your digital presence. You know, what can the average person do too? Get off of Gmail, get off of Google, get off of Facebook. You can use ProtonMail. It's based in Switzerland, much more private, much more secure. It's open source. Open source means that they're not going to hide any back doors to spy on you. The code is open for everybody to see. Go to ProtonMail, get rid of Dropbox, go to a company called Treasure It, also based in Switzerland. Switzerland, incidentally, is very favorable to diversify your digital presence. Use a VPN. That disguises where you are connecting to the internet from and doesn't allow your internet service provider to see everything you do online. So those are the two things that I would say that anybody can do. Anybody from an Uber driver, a freelancer, people of very modest means, they can diversify their digital presence and start building up a nest egg in money that isn't controlled by anybody.
Yeah, great. So if they want to take it to the next step, would that be maybe setting up a bank account overseas and getting a visa, like a residency visa? I think Panama has a pretty easy program, maybe not for citizenship or a passport, but just to get a visa to where if you wanted to leave the United States for more than 3 months, you know, just with a visitor visa, you could go to Panama and spend some time there by setting up a bank account with, maybe $5,000 or $10,000. Do those types of opportunities still exist?
Yes, they do. I'll take that one aspect at a time. First, having a foreign bank account is not as valuable as it used to be. It still provides some value, but honestly, all these governments are all sharing information. I mean, it's not going to be private, so forget about privacy. There's no privacy with a foreign bank account, especially if you're an American. The U.S. government and the IRS has basically coerced the entire planet, unless you own a bank in Cuba or North Korea or Iran. They're gonna send all your financial information to the IRS. So forget about privacy. You shouldn't even be thinking about not doing that, because if you're an American, the penalties are draconian. So it's kind of a stupid thing. And to have money in fiat money in this inflationary time too doesn't make a heck of a lot of sense. But it does make sense to have some money outside of your home country in case something like Cyprus happens in your home country. So you want to, that was a perfect example.
Or just the lockdown I call it the cerveza sickness. You know, you get a lockdown and you're like, okay, I want to check out here for a few months. Bam, you got a bank account set up, you got a visa, you're ready to go.
Yes, that is a huge benefit. So it adds a layer of protection. So you want that. I would view it more as spending money. I wouldn't use it as a savings. I would not use it as a savings vehicle, even if it's in Swiss franc or, strong currency. I think there are just superior savings vehicle. Gold, Bitcoin come to mind. So that is what I think about offshore bank accounts. Good to have. You should have them, but don't think they're going to give you too much value. In terms of residencies, I personally would have avoided getting residency in another country until this whole COVID hysteria, because typically when you get sucked into a residency system, you're sucked into their tax system, their reporting system. It's not fun. You don't want that. Usually it's better to just be a tourist, but you can't really do that anymore now with all these COVID restrictions. A lot of countries aren't letting tourists in. I'm in Argentina. They're not letting tourists in Argentina. You need to be a resident to come into Argentina, or a citizen. Many countries are doing the same thing. So that's kind of changed the game. So I do think it is a good idea to get a residency in a place like Panama that is very friendly to people's money, to freedom loving people. They're not going to really bother you. They're not going to tax your money that's made outside of Panama. So I think it is valuable to have a residency, because now a foreign residency in a place like this, because now it's you need to, because who knows when they're going to shut the borders. And when the borders are shut and you want to go in as a tourist, you might not be able to. You won't be able to, for sure.
Right. Yeah, right. Another thing I like about Panama is it's just such a travel hub. I mean, from the Panama airport there, you can just go almost anywhere with a direct flight to almost anywhere in North America or South America, for sure. So I think that's another advantage there. How about visas through investment? And I'm not talking about the, we'll talk about the citizenship, the passports, but I know I've got an investor visa for Colombia because of the amount of real estate that I've purchased there. And I had my assistant set up the whole thing. And I believe that takes me to getting closer to getting my passport. I don't know if that's in 3 years, 5 years, but how difficult or hard is it with most countries to get a visa if you invest in real estate in that country?
Well, every country is different. And then within each country, the rules are changing constantly. So this is a moving target. It's a big moving target, and they can change the rules too. They can up the limits of investment. They can cancel the program. It's possible. It's possible in a lot of countries, and definitely is a serious option if you're looking at that.
Yeah. Okay. So then let's take it to the next level. And this person has significant resources. They've got a lot of flexibility, and they may be looking at getting another passport. And last time I checked into them when I was in St. Bart's, I saw that a lot of the Caribbean passports were pretty much on sale, like fire sale, because they're trying to really get in as much revenue as they could because their tourism revenue took such a hit. So walk me through those Caribbean passports. Are they still on sale? Are there some there that you like, some that you don't like?
Sure. Just the concept. Everybody should have more than one passport. I don't like the fact that we have passports, that we need passports. They're more akin to slave cards, basically. You know, government owns you. It's a government form of ID. There's nothing magical about passports. And they use them to restrict people's travel options. They're used to coerce you. The U.S. government any government can cancel your passport, revoke your citizenship, basically at the stroke of a pen if they don't like you, or they claim that you've done something they don't like, or you allegedly owe them in money and taxes. So it is a very important thing to have, because if you don't have another passport, they can effectively stop your ability to travel with an administrative process. It's a very scary thought. And not a paranoid thought. This happens a lot, especially.
Okay. And I'd also remind people back in March of 2020, or that in for most of the year there, it was almost impossible to travel with a U.S. passport. Like, it was very difficult to get into a lot of countries, if not impossible. I remember I was in St. Bart's for 2 or 3 months, and I couldn't go over to St. Martin because I just had an American passport. They just would not let me in.
Yes, and that's another reason to have multiple passports, is because these rules change. And in this COVID environment, they're letting some passport holders in. They're not allowing other passport holders in. So it increases your options, and that's a good thing. You want to have options. You don't want bureaucrats to arbitrarily restrict where you can go. That's not a good thing. So having a second passport is a good option. Third or fourth, if you can, too. And these countries in the Caribbean are offering, well, there's many ways to a second passport, but they're not, it's not an easy thing to get. It's not a cheap thing to get. It takes time. Don't even think about going into the realm of bribing, you know, people in countries. You know, some services offer this. You want to make sure that if you're going for a second passport, you know 100% it's legal, it's above board. Right, you're just asking for more problems. So one of the ways you can get a second citizenship is through ancestry. If you have ancestry in certain countries in Europe, offer it. Italy, Poland, Ireland, Spain are the top ones off the top of my head. And you can get a passport, as you mentioned before, by being a resident and being naturalized after a certain amount of time. That's another option, but that takes time. The fastest way to do it is to just buy one, because there are countries that have legitimate investor citizenship by investment programs that are totally legal, that have been around for decades, and are have been used by thousands of people. And these countries are in the Caribbean. There's really only two that I find interesting personally, and that's St. Kitts and Dominica, because they are the only programs. There's a bunch of other countries in the Caribbean that do offer citizenship by investment, but the only two that have stood the test of time, that have had thousands, maybe tens of thousands of people go through them, are St. Kitts and Dominica. And that's very important, because if the political winds change, you know, they can cancel the program, they can revoke passports. So these things are important considerations. This is highly unlikely in a place where it's been embedded in the culture. It's been embedded in their government budgets, as these two. So yep. St. Kitts has been around the longest. That one's been around since, like, I think 1983. And Dominica's been around since 1993, give or take. So these are the ones that have been established. I would look, the St. Kitts is the more expensive one. I'm not sure how much it is now or whether it's what the exact price is off the top of my head. But it's the more expensive one. But it's the one that's the oldest, too, the most reliable. So I would look at Dominica and St. Kitts.
Yeah, and by the way, great visa-free travel. Most people think that if you get one of these passports, it's like getting one from Afghanistan, or you're not going to be able to get in anywhere. That's not true.
No, not at all. They have, I believe they both give you access to the EU and many countries in South America. I don't think they give you access to the US, but you can always get a visa through the normal process. But it does give you access to a lot of countries. So no, they're a very good option for people who might not have other options.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on Puerto Rico?
Oh, yes. Well, we were one of probably the first people to do an in-depth study of Puerto Rico. In 2014, we released a product, a video guide on everything to do with Puerto Rico, moving there for tax benefits. I think it's great. I think it's a wonderful thing for people who can take advantage, people in their businesses who can take advantage of these tax benefits while they last. It's possible, though. I mean, it's much more conceivable now that Puerto Rico could become a state. They could make it a state. You've heard this is not just a rumor anymore. This is a credible option that could happen. So how long this option lasts, I don't know, but it certainly was an attractive option in the past.
Yeah, I think you get grandfathered in, but there's just there's a lot of cross currents there that people need to consider before they move forward. But with any of these options, I think that, well, any of the options that mean you spending time there, you got to go there first and foremost and just see if you like it. I mean, we talk about Medellin. I get so many questions about Colombia and Medellin and say, you know, they've never been there, but they're trying to plan their whole entire life. Like, where can my kids go to school and all these other things, bank accounts and whatnot. I'm like, listen, just go there for a week first and foremost, because you could go there and you could absolutely hate it. You never know. And then you got to change the course of direction. But what do you think the kind of the basic advice you can give for people who are looking to diversify their political risk and their currency risk? I mean, I know we talked about gold and Bitcoin, but are there fiats out there that if they have to be in a fiat that you'd be interested in, like the Singapore dollar? Maybe we talked about Switzerland. And then what do you think the basics are for that political diversification above and beyond what we talked about?
Sure. I'm not really into playing the currency arbitrage game. I think if you're going to be in a fiat currency, just be in the dollar, frankly, and then be in, you know, gold and Bitcoin as your long-term stores of value. And if you have to be in a fiat currency, basically, you look at all these other currencies, they're basically just the U.S. dollar plus country risk is basically what a lot of these currencies are. You might have some that are better, Singapore dollar, maybe not the Hong Kong dollar, Swiss franc. But to me, it's just totally uninteresting to try to play off. I mean, I think they're all crap, honestly. Right. They're all crap. And I'm not trying to play a game where I'm trying to have the, you know, the best fiat currency. It's just not a game I want to play personally.
Okay. So, Nick, I know we're running short on time. Where can my viewers and listeners go to find out more about what you do?
Sure. They can follow me on Twitter at Nick Giambruno and follow my writings at kcresearch.com.
Awesome, buddy. I appreciate your time. I cannot wait to do it again. I cannot wait to hang out with you in Medellin and we can get a bottle of aguardiente, if I'm pronouncing that right. We'll do a little salsa and have some fun.
Thanks, buddy. No, I can't wait too. We'll definitely be in touch.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.